Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We've got a show packed with music and movies today. Right now, I would like to welcome director Kevin Wilmott. He has made the film Bunker Hill, which opens at the Santa Fe Film Center on August 9th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you, Mary.
It's great to have you. Now, this is an interesting film set in small-town America. There's some kind of terrorist attack that's not really defined, in which communication from the whole rest of the world is cut off. And there is a very rapid breakdown of the rule of law and a descent into mob rule. Now, first of all, what was the inspiration for this film?
Well, you know, I live in Kansas, and I grew up in Kansas, and I was teaching. I teach at Kansas University, and I was the day on 9/11, when 9/11 happened, I was teaching that day, and as I left after being inside, you know, watching on the TV, like I think most Americans were doing that day. And I was driving by the gas station, which is right down the street from our school, and there was a huge line there, and the prices were triple what they're like. The gas prices were like how much they are now, you know, and it really frightened me. And you know, and the first thing that comes to your mind is what do they know that I don't know? And it really struck me about, you know, the fear that we've had since 9/11. That so much of it is based on what we don't know. So, you know, it's the fear of the unknown about what will happen next. And I wanted to try to explore in examining what happens when there's a possible terrorist attack. We really don't say if it is or not, you know, but there could
right.
be something. And how you know, how a small community, which hopefully I think is a reflection of all of us, how they react.
It's interesting when you say, what do they know that I don't know? I mean, part of what this film explores is who is that they?
Exactly. You know, and that's the thing that I think we've had to wrestle with so much since 9/11. You know, the worry about what will happen next and what will that look like and how will that occur. And so in that fear has made us make a lot of bad choices, in my opinion. And so, you know, we wanted to try to explore that reality of what could happen if something horrible happens to us again.
Now, the film is set in Kansas, and as you say, you live in Kansas. May we hope that this is not a realistic portrayal of Kansas with respect to the violence and super macho attitude of just about every male in the film?
Well, you know, I think it's not a reflection of Kansas, clearly, but I think it is a reflection of us as Americans, you know, in the sense that, you know, I think after 9/11, we kind of, all of us kind of conceded to a sense of mob rule. You know, we went to war against a country that didn't attack us on 9/11, and so we all kind of relinquished our best senses to people who kind of had a cowboy macho mentality. You know, there was a lot of talk about, you know, you're not for us, you're against us, and a lot of cliches that come out of Westerns. And so in a lot of ways, I think we've lived in a Western for the last 8 years. And so that genre seemed like the appropriate genre to really look at in terms of, to use in terms of looking at these issues.
It's kind of a Western and kind of a sort of, you know, road warrior type thriller.
Sure.
What were some of the movies that you were looking at and thinking about as you know, models or inspirations for this film, Bunker Hill?
Well, probably the biggest influence is actually a Twilight Zone episode called "The Monsters Are on Maple Street."
Wow.
And in that episode, I'm a big Rod Serling fan, and Rod Serling, you know, just I think dealt with just about everything on that TV show in terms of the issues that affect our lives today and probably in the future. And in that episode, it showed how a small neighborhood, basically because of the fear of the unknown, turns on itself. And so, you know, the realities of the macho attitude comes from things like the posse comitatus, you know, which was a very strong group that existed in the 1980s, which is kind of was a kind of a semi-form of the Klan. But a lot of those beliefs and those sentiments, you know, they still exist in various forms today. And I don't think those are just in Kansas. I think you could say those things exist in every place in America, you know, and fear of other races, fear of other religions, you know, fear in general has caused us a lot of problems. And so, you know, what I think Rod Serling showed us and prophetically kind of told us was that ends up being the scenario we seem to be, you know, dealt with on a regular basis.
We're talking to Kevin Wilmot. Now, the film, it's interesting. It plays with racial stereotypes. The character played by James McDaniel is an African-American who just got out of prison, but then we find out that his crime was, he's a Wall Street executive, his crime was insider trading.
Right.
And then the man from India/Pakistan, a Muslim guy, wears a cowboy hat. He has a son who's a follower of Gandhi. But the but the people who most conform to their racial stereotypes are the redneck white guys. Are you,
right,
like, turning the tables on movie conventions and stereotypes?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I think, you know, we try to show that people are a little more complicated than what you think. You know, certainly there are those guys in the film that had belonged to the posse in the 1980s, but then there are other people that are white in the film that were not part of it. But I think, you know, the thing that we try to show with it is that everyone in the community, to a large degree, you know, kind of conceded to the fear. And so the fear only works in these, you know, difficult ways, in these bad ways on people if people don't stand up against it. And so, you know, the racial stereotypes, you know, apply and come to the surface and affect people and they, you know, people buy them as true only when people don't stand up against them. And so that's again, I think, what happened to us after 9/11. We didn't do a very good job of examining what our intentions were. We bought a lot of assumptions. We bought a lot of things about the other countries and other religions, and those things have led us into a, you know, a tragic war.
Do you think that it's possible through art or through other means to actually kind of inoculate an entire population against the dangers of mob rule?
Well, I think the thing that a lot of Westerns have shown us, you know, the Oxbow Incident and High Noon and, you know, things that are both, you know, mob rule and also, you know, just how people don't stand up against evil, the thing seems to be that you have to be willing to kind of go against your community. You have to be willing to stand up and pay personally for what you believe. And that's very difficult for all of us to do, especially difficult in a small community because there's so much at stake in a small community. You know, your livelihood is clearly at stake, your status in the community, how you get along with others, all of that you have to risk by standing up against, you know, you're in ultimately your neighbor and saying, I don't think this is right. I think this is the wrong move. We're going down the wrong path. And so people tend not to do that. And I think all of us as Americans kind of didn't do that after 9/11. And we let, you know, the president kind of run roughshod. And now we really regret it.
There's also, I mean, in your film, you have the guy who comes in from out of town, and he is speaking in, you know, in a lot of ways, a more rational manner than some of the people there. But do you want to ally yourself with the new guy who's also a black guy when you know, everybody else is people? And it comes up over and over in the film, you know, these are people I've known all my life.
Right.
And that's something, you know, that makes us all think about, you know, where our loyalties are, and to whom and to what principles at any given moment.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, it's very difficult. People, I think, don't understand how difficult that is. And I think in any community, you know, I think it could happen in a large city, obviously, too. But you know, it's even more difficult when people are close on you like that. And the fact that, you know, the Peter Salem character played by James McDaniels is black, you know, it just complicates it because he's a stranger. We don't know him. He's black. You know, it's kind of like the Obama thing where people, you know, he's got the funny name and he, you know, people still believe he's Muslim. And because you're kind of an outsider and you're different, you know, assumptions are made and they're very difficult to divorce from the mainstream idea. And that's what happens in the film. It's like, you know, there's several other stereotypes that come out about people, and because of the fear, people go to those assumptions immediately. Just like, you know, I remember in the Oklahoma City bombing, I mean, when that happened, immediately people thought they were Middle Eastern terrorists, and they ended up being the guy who did it, Timothy McVeigh, made the bomb in my hometown in Junction City, Kansas. So,
good heavens.
So you know, it lets you know that you know it's very complicated what we're dealing with now, and stereotypes and those assumptions and the difficulties of community, you know, and that's the thing about small town America now. It is changing. You know, it's becoming much more. The immigrants are coming into these small communities and. And so a lot of these towns would be all white at one time, and now they're Pakistanis live there, and Indians, and Mexican Americans, and so it is far more diverse than it had been in the past, and that puts this extra pressure on people in terms of how they're going to get along in this complex kind of new environment.
We're talking to Kevin Wilmot about his film Bunker Hill, which opens at the Santa Fe Film Center on the 9th of August. Now, this is an independent film. First of all, how did you get the funding and these actors together to make it all happen? You've got some really first-class, very experienced actors in this film.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, what I try to do is, with the films I make, it's all about really the script. You know, you've got to have a really good screenplay that will attract people because, you know, you can't pay them a lot of money. So you're offering them the opportunity to be in a film that hopefully is saying some things and also giving them an opportunity to play some roles that sometimes they don't often get to play. And so, you know, the real coup was getting Saeed Jaffrey to play Mr. Farouk, who, you know, was in Gandhi and Passage to India and the man who would be king. And so we really had wanted him to play the part, and we were very, very lucky to get him. And I think he just does a really terrific job in the film.
I looked him up. He's been in 166 movies.
Wow. Well, you know, he is an amazing person. He went to school with Marilyn Monroe, and you know, he just has a wonderful, wonderful history in film, and, you know, really is probably the best-known Indian actor in the world. And we, you know, we just felt very privileged to get him to be in our film. And I think, you know, he said it was the first time he got to play a cowboy.
Right.
And you know, it's one of the things we really love about the film is that, you know, people get to play things they typically don't get to play. And as you were saying earlier about the stereotypes, you know, that's the thing that it's hard to judge people now because it is becoming a much more diverse world, and people, you know, are just not what they seem on the surface.
Now, this film was recently screened at an ACLU event in Washington. What kind of reactions did you get to it, and what kind of discussions were engendered by it?
Well, it was a really great screening, and I think, you know, the film is pretty tough in the sense that it really, you know, it jolts you a bit in the end, and what happens in the end. And I think, you know, I'm really pleased about that because I try to make films that really lead to discussion, and, you know, to examine these issues that we're tackling, you know, now in the country. And so, you know, the ACLU screening was a beautiful example of that in terms of, you know, the discussion we had afterwards. We talked a great deal about, you know, the post 9/11 fear, the politics of fear, you know, the Patriot Act, you know, all of the things that have happened to us since 9/11 that I think many of us are questioning now. You know, the film kind of shows, I think, in various ways how those choices were made, and now it's, you know, it's, you know, I've always thought a lot about these issues in terms of the 1960s and Dr. King and people like that who were spied upon in the 1960s by J. Edgar Hoover and those folks. And you know, we love Dr. King now, but at that time, you know, we thought he was a communist. And we were spying on him, and we thought horrible things about him, and we kind of tortured him in many ways. And so it shows you how, you know, in the present time, we can be wrong about things, and we can make horrible mistakes at the time at a time of crisis. And,
that's right.
And so, you know, I think the lesson of that is you have to really be careful about how you deal with new realities. And I think that's the thing the film, I think, shows us, is how are you going to deal with freedom today in this new complicated reality?
Kevin Wilmot is the director and co-writer of the film Bunker Hill, which opens at the Santa Fe Film Center on August 9th. And actor Wes Studi will be there at the opening. And you are coming into Santa Fe as well, is that correct?
Yes, yes. And Wes is a star of a new film I'm just completing now called The Only Good Indian. And I'm really looking forward to bringing that to Santa Fe in the near future. He does a really great job in the film. I think people are really going to love his performance.
And that'll be an excuse to get you back on the radio when you return.
Oh, sounds very good.
Kevin Wilmot, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for a great interview.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by phone, Ida Kavafian. She is the Artistic Director of Music from Angel Fire. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, how are you? Good job on my name.
Oh, is that an Armenian name?
Yes, again.
Okay. Well, so you're the Artistic Director of Music from Angel Fire, and that's a music festival that runs the second half of August, August 15th to September 1st. Why, of all places, Angel Fire, little town east of Taos?
Well, you know, we do, while we are based in Angel Fire, we do play concerts all throughout the northern New Mexico region. So we visit Raton and Las Vegas and Taos, and then we have a lot of outreach concerts in the area schools. So while we're based in Angel Fire, we do travel around the I think the part of the country, part of the state that I think probably doesn't have as much music as the Santa Fe area.
So that's the idea, is to bring music not only to people visiting from out of town, but to local people in northern New Mexico?
Exactly.
So what are the different venues like where you'll be playing?
Well, funny you should ask that. This year we, you know, usually we play in the Taos Community Auditorium in Taos, and that's undergoing some renovation. So this year our home will be the SMU campus at Fort Berkwin, which is a really a unique kind of setting, and I think a beautiful, beautiful kind of compound. And it'll be a new experience for all of us. So our Taos concerts will be there, except for the youth, the family youth concert, which will be at Batan Hall in downtown Taos. In Angel Fire, we play in the community center most of the concerts. And then we have two very, very special concerts where we're playing the complete Brandenburg Concerti in the United Church of Angel Fire, which is just a spectacular setting, both inside and out. You know, we do play before the sun goes down, and so you can enjoy in the back of the musicians the gorgeous mountains and Angel Fire. And that's on August 17th, and then we do the second one on August 28th.
It's funny, when you hear the complete Brandenburg Concerti in the United Church of Angel Fire, you think that you're just guaranteed to become enlightened by the time you get out of the church.
Well, in addition to the music, we have what we call musical conversations on those evenings at the United Church, and I start the evening with about maybe a 20-minute talk about the music that's going to be played that evening. So, and then usually there's some back and forth between the audience and myself, and then we come out and play the music. And hopefully something in those talks will be helpful to people listening to the music.
We're talking to Ida Kavafian about music from Angel Fire. Now, you are the artistic director. How do you choose the pieces and the artists who will be played and be playing?
Well, that is my job, choosing the artists and then choosing the music. And I think it's a job that's very much intertwined. Sometimes it's like putting a puzzle together, because in addition to choosing the music, you want to choose the right artist to play that particular kind of music. So that's an additional challenge, which is to make sure that everybody is set in a piece that, you know, they can shine in individually and collectively. So it is like a giant jigsaw puzzle, but I start usually with the very important part of our festival, which is to commission each year a piece by an American composer. We're very lucky this year to have Joan Tower, who is celebrating her 70th birthday with us, which is a wonderful time. So,
and she's also going to be at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival.
That's right. She's and earlier in the summer, we were working together at some other festivals as well. So it's great to have a 3-time Grammy winner as part of our little festival in Angel Fire.
So do you ever have, when you've chosen some of the artists, the musicians, you know, one of them will come up to you and say, I'm dying to play Beethoven piano sonata numbers, whatever, you know, and then you let them help you program it in that way?
Sometimes I do. I think I do encourage people to make requests, and I say I can't always get them in, but I will try if I can, and if it works within a program. Each program has to have some kind of its own pace and reason for being. So it's sometimes it doesn't always work, because what you want to do is each time the audience comes in, you want to take them on a special kind of journey. And so you don't want to just tack together anything, you know, one after the other, then have an intermission and stick something else in the second half. So it's a kind of complicated process, but often I can work in requests. And then we have a couple of unusual concerts. One is called a salon concert, which is this year. It's on the 24th. This is a concert where we do skits and we do lighter music and have more fun and joke and then show off different virtuosic aspects of people's techniques and it's a really fun afternoon. We actually put some furniture on the stage to make it feel like the audience is in our living room with us, and it's a really fun concert, after which we have our fundraising auction, which is a great part of our budget. So,
which is that the one about the painted violins?
Well, that's a separate project altogether this year. We have 25 violins signifying the 25 years of our festival that have been painted by area artists, many of our poster artists, some of the really great New Mexico artists and Southwest artists like David LaFell and Sherry McGraw, Barbara Zering, Doug West, names that that all of you guys know out here, who have been artists that have helped us in the past, either with a poster. We have a poster each year, an image that we have on our programs, or that have donated art for us for our auctions in order to raise money to run the festival. Anyway, we have these violins that were unvarnished raw wood and sent to all these artists. And they've created these very special works of art for a special auction, a bidding that's going to take place throughout the festival. And then the final day of that will be the 31st, our last concert in Angel Fire. It's really great. You should see them. People can see the photographs of the painted violins on our website, musicfromangelfire.org.
You are also a musician. You're a violinist, and you'll be playing at the festival. How do you balance your work as a musician and the artistic director?
Oh, that's difficult, because sometimes I give myself too much to do because I don't want anybody else to have too much to do, and sometimes I'll go through a program and I'll say, oh, that person's already playing. I'll just play the piece myself, and then I'll end up with way too much music to learn and play, and then I have to sort of redo things. But, you know, first and foremost, I'm a performer, so I guess that's one of the ways to look at it. And I do the same thing that I do for everybody else. I program the things that I think I have something to say and that I particularly like.
We're talking about music from Angel Fire. Now, the concerts have some great names. Youthful Exuberance is one of them. Carnival on Ice is another. Dramatic Extremes. Explain some of these names.
Well, it's an interesting process how those names come about. Usually, as I said before about the programs and how I think it's really important to place pieces on the program next to other pieces that will tell a story or at least give a special kind of variety or maybe a theme that runs throughout the program. Youthful Exuberance is referring to the young composer in residence that we have, Christopher Weiss, who is a student at the Curtis Institute, who is youthful himself, and then we have a Mendelssohn quartet on that program, and of course Mendelssohn died before you could say he was really out of his youth, and
right.
Then it is being performed by young musicians from the Curtis Institute, which is part of our young artist program. So that seemed to be a name that, for example, that's how that name came about. And then other names have a significance within the programs themselves. I have Festive Fiddling, and that refers to Mark O'Connor, the great bluegrass fiddler who's going to be with us for our first 10 days of our festival, which is a great treat.
Now, is he going to be playing bluegrass music or classical or some combination?
A combination, actually. The main project is to perform his string quartets, number 2 and number 3, and we've been playing those throughout the summer at various festivals, and we're going to record those and then tour with them in a future project. So I think that was one of the ways we were able to get Mark to come out here and be with us. And he's going to work with the young artists from the Curtis Institute, and he's going to teach them a little bit about improvising and bluegrass fiddling. And so it's sort of a combination. There's some bluegrass in the second quartet, and then there's sort of an old-time fiddling style in the third quartet. And then he himself will do some solos where he just is just stupendous, just the most amazing playing, and much of it improvised, of course.
We live in such interesting musical times where there are people who have total crossover between such really local, regional genres like bluegrass and then classical music.
Yes, we sure do, and I think there are very few of us, and I would not include myself, there are very few people that I feel are successful, really successful at both. I mean, there are people who do both well, but I think there are very few that can really be considered great at both, and that's just an indication of how specialized most of these fields are, you know. But I do think it's interesting for instance, for myself, to stretch my own horizons and learn something about fiddling from Mark O'Connor. And he would tell you the same thing. For him, it's interesting to play with classical people because it also it stretches his horizons as well. So I think, you know, if it's done well, I think it's a great thing. I think if it's done as a marketing tool and to further someone's career, then I don't think it's good.
Right. Now, you were saying before that this is really a vehicle for getting music to parts of northern New Mexico that don't have the just ongoing musical embarrassment of riches that we have here in Santa Fe. Do you also have people coming from far away to the festival?
We do, actually. A lot of people will make it a weekend of it and come to a concert in Taos, and then Angel Fire, and then Las Vegas, or some combination. It is somewhat of a destination for people that appreciate the kind of music that we're presenting. I think what surprises people the most is the caliber of musicians that are in residence, and of course the quality of the music. So it would be as high a quality or as great musicians as you would find on the major stages all over the world, and yet you can hear them in a much more intimate and sort of personal setting. and we become part of the community, and we participate in various community activities, golf scrambles, you know, things like that. And for the musicians, I think it's extra special because it's more unusual and it's more personal.
Has Angel Fire developed an industry of lodging and restaurants and so on around the festival?
It's still a small place. It's a very nice place, and there are a lot of rentals that are available, and there is a resort hotel. There's a fantastic golf course, and they're building they're doing some building over there for their clubhouse. And I think it's still a very small place. I mean, Angel Fire has maybe 1,000 year-round residents, and so it's still very small, and I think that's what I particularly like about it.
Ida Kavafian is the artistic director of Music from Angel Fire. They can be found at the website musicfromangelfire.org.
Is that correct?
And we want to thank you very much for being here on the Radio Cafe. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, just my thanks for having me on, and hope to see you at some of the concerts. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
We're going to have a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Brad Rothschild. He is writer and executive producer of the film Homeland, which opens on August 10th at the Santa Fe Film Center. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is a type of Romeo and Juliet story. You have an Israeli young man and a Palestinian young woman, both living in New York City. They fall in love with each other. Now, this probably happens in the U.S. quite often, if not in, perhaps not so much in Israel. Was there a real-life inspiration for the story?
I think you're right in that it happens probably more here in the United States than it would happen in Israel. But the story really is not inspired by any real-life events that I heard of. It's just I was once I was writing another script, and an idea popped into my head for a love story between an Israeli and a Palestinian, not really based on anything that I had known of, but just something that I thought would be a good vehicle to help describe what's really going on in the Middle East.
The film brings up a lot of questions, including the relative merits of traditional Muslim family life and the more free secular American life and the places where those two things conflict. Did you talk to a lot of Palestinian immigrants and their American or Americanized children in preparation for making this film?
I did, actually. Paterson, New Jersey is very close to New York City, and there's a very large Palestinian population out there in Paterson. And I spent a decent amount of time talking to people there and learning about how they lived here in the United States. But I also lived in Israel for a couple of years and got to know about Israeli and Palestinian society that way.
You are a New Yorker yourself?
I was born in New York City, raised in New Jersey.
So the characters in this film really voice the much larger conflicts of Israel and Palestine, and the Israeli young man, Kobe, who recently landed in New York City from Israel, he works with his friend who runs an ice cream parlor, and the two of them express two very different Jewish perspectives, one of them more thoughtful, perhaps one of them a little more aggressive, but both of them so familiar. And I have to say, what I felt when I was watching this film and they were talking and arguing, the utter futility of talking and arguing, you know, just going around in the same circles over and over again. Tell me your perspective on that whole kind of political conversation that goes on.
That political conversation has been going on since 1967 in Israel, since Israel took possession of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And that's really, to me, that is the dialogue that goes on every day in Israel. That's the dialogue that goes on among American Jews. Kobe represents, as you said, he's a little bit more open and maybe a little bit more sensitive to the other side, while his friend is probably more closed-minded and a bit aggressive. And I think that really represents a good spectrum of the political dialogue in Israel.
And that's been going on for, that makes it 41 years now.
Yeah, if not longer. And some would say that it goes back as far as the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, or even the beginning of immigration, Jewish immigration, to what was then Palestine in the late 19th century.
So when you make a film like this and you represent not only that conversation, but then the conversations that happen between these two young, you can't quite call them young lovers, but young people falling in love with each other, again, it's so familiar. What is the process of portraying that on film like, both for you kind of as a, perhaps as a catharsis, but also as a vehicle for communicating that to others?
Well, one of the important points in this movie that the movie tries to make is that every side in a conflict has its own narrative, its own story that it passes down from generation to generation. And if you allow yourself to believe only in the version of history that you're taught and not to accept that there is another version of history, then you'll never be able to reach any sort of accommodation with anyone who may have a different opinion than you. And the idea behind this film is for each side to acknowledge that the other has a narrative that may conflict with their own and say the only way we are going to move forward in a positive direction is if we each put our own narratives behind us and try to move forward. And during the filming, this was a point that was hammered home throughout the filming, and there were Israeli actors on set. There were Muslim actors as well, and this was a point of contention.
Well, I was wondering about that during the actual filming. Did some of these conversations actually happen off camera?
Well, I think more before the filming took place, and when we were casting for the movie, we ran into some people who refused to participate in our project because of the nature of it.
Why?
Some said that they couldn't see themselves playing opposite a Palestinian or opposite an Israeli. We had a couple of Israeli actors who just said they couldn't see themselves doing this. And we had a couple of Muslim actors who said the same thing.
Wow, amazing. You know, it's interesting. I had on the air pretty recently some young people who were involved in a project here in Santa Fe called Creativity for Peace, which is a summer camp for teenage girls that brings together Palestinian and Israeli teenage girls, and they have all these, you know, conversations and activities and processes and so on. And I asked that the question about history, you know, talking about the history of your, you know, the two different historical stories. And they said, and their director said, you know, talking about history never gets you anywhere. It's only when you speak from your heart that you can actually move forward.
I think that's absolutely true. And again, what we tried to do in this film is show two young people speaking from their hearts and trying to move forward. But at the same time, you have forces on each side that want to prevent that from happening. And that's really the tragedy of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and, quite frankly, many ethnic conflicts around the world.
Yeah, it's certainly, I mean, we won't ruin the film for people, but it certainly calls into question the overriding power of love when there's so much else going against you.
Yeah, and the message of the film is one of hope and peace and love, but it's also, I try to keep it grounded in reality. So, again, without ruining the film for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, that's really what the story is about.
We're talking to Brad Rothschild about his film Homeland, which screens at the Santa Fe Film Center on the 10th of August. That's the opening night. Now, you were the speechwriter and director of communications for the Mission of Israel to the United Nations. Tell us about that. That's an incredible job that you had.
Yeah, it was one of the high points of my professional career, obviously. I worked at the Mission of Israel during the mid-90s when the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians was really in full gear. And there was really a lot of hope back then, a lot of hope that both sides would be able to move forward and put the past behind them. I was fortunate enough to work with an ambassador who, at the time, the late Gad Yaacobi, who was very instrumental in trying to move the peace process forward here in the United Nations.
Did your work there in some way inspire you to, or awaken in you the desire to make a film?
Well, I have always loved writing, and speech writing was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed working in the high-pressured environment of international diplomacy and politics. And when I left that, I had always wanted to come back somehow to writing and to writing about the Middle East. And, you know, when I got this idea, I said, okay, this is it. This is what I want to be doing.
So tell us about the making of this film. It's an independent film with mostly new actors. How did you assemble the cast and get together the funding to make this film?
Once I wrote the script, I brought it to a former teacher of mine who taught me a screenwriting class in a continuing education program, and his name is Michael Eldridge. And I brought him the script, and I told him that I wanted to try to make this, but I brought it to him and said that I wanted him to be the director, and he agreed. I put together the funding, basically passing the hat around to friends and family, and we both believed that this was an important project, and we decided to move forward with it. I was working in a corporate job, which I left to make the movie. We filmed it in about 23 days, which for a feature film is pretty short, but we didn't have a big budget, so we had to move quickly. And it was an incredible experience.
How did you find the actors and choose the actors that you used?
The actors we posted on Craigslist, and we put some ads in trade magazines as well. So Backstage was one of our sources.
Craigslist seems to be the source of everything these days. That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, you put a little one-line sentence that says "looking for Middle Eastern actors and actresses." And this is New York City, so it's not too hard to find them.
So you had a lot of people trying out for those parts.
Yeah, we had we met with a lot of people before we decided who we were going to cast for this film.
And of course, the two lead actors, both good actors and very easy to look at, shall we say. It seems like the film is a good vehicle for discussion with people who have strong feelings about this. Have you shown the film and then had discussions afterwards?
The film actually engenders discussion pretty much organically, and people, and the screenings that we've had, people have walked out talking about it, and people certainly come up to me and come up to Michael Eldridge, who's the director, to engage us in discussion and debate after seeing the film, and we hear everything. We hear things from people who are so touched by the film and feel that it's so realistic that they're in tears. And then we get people who are angry when they talk about the film because they feel that their side was slighted in this movie or the other side was portrayed in the way that they didn't feel was appropriate. But I think when each side can tell you that they think that you got it wrong, then you got it right.
Yeah, that may well be. Now, here's the big question to answer in 3 minutes or less. Why do you think it is so? I mean, what are the reasons that you think it is so difficult to achieve peace between Israel and Palestine?
Wow, unfortunately, I think that as the conflict continues and as it takes on more of a religious element rather than two nationalisms going against each other, I think that that's what makes it more intractable. When you have two sides who say, well, my God told me this, and the other side says, no, my God says this, there's really not a lot of room for compromise there. When it's a national movement like Zionism versus a Palestinian national movement, then there's room for compromise. You can certainly come up with a scenario for some sort of resolution that maybe 100% of each side won't be happy, but a majority of each side will be happy. But when it delves into a religious conflict, then it becomes much, much more difficult to solve.
And that's actually represented in the film by the brother of the young Palestinian woman who, shall we say, I guess you'd say he goes to a more fundamentalist kind of practice, and that leads to part of the tremendous conflict in the film.
Yeah, he becomes more religious, more of an Islamist as the movie goes on, and that's really also it shows how he had problems integrating into the United States. And when you feel like you're a little bit of a fish out of water, you cling more to the ways that you know, that you're more familiar with. And that's why he was more attracted to a more radical brand of Islam, because it reminded him more of what he thought it was supposed to be like back in Palestine.
And also, he was drawn to it when things started going badly in his own life, which
exactly.
is often when people grasp on to outer structures.
That's absolutely right.
Will you be here in Santa Fe for this, any of the screenings of the film?
Yes, I'm actually going to be in for the first screening on Sunday.
Well, we will see you then, Brad Rothschild, writer and executive producer of the film Homeland, which is at the Santa Fe Film Center. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.